A warm welcome to this week's edition of Remember Palestine, the new front line for the Middle East, with me, your host, Amina Taylor. On today's RP, it's being described as a collision course between Palestine, America, Israel, and their supporters. The push from the Palestinian leadership for statehood. The bid that would come before the UN in September has already seen vocal opposition in America, and it's threatened to cut off aid and impose sanctions on any nation that supports the PA's push for independent state status. What happens next for the Palestinians? Would statehood change things on the ground for them? In a deeply fraught issue, there's the current state of the Palestinian economy and the threat of further incursions into Gaza to consider. As well as examining this developing story, we'll be catching up with a group of students who went from Goldsmiths College in London, who went to meet some of their peers in Gaza to see the conditions there for themselves. But first, we're going to be going down and finding out just what exactly is the view of Palestinians in Gaza on this issue.
Following nearly two decades of futile peace talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority since 1993, Palestinian PA chief Mahmoud Abbas will turn to the UN with a proposal for statehood set to be voted on in September. Israel and the United States opposed the move, saying the recognition of a Palestinian state should be the result of a negotiated peace agreement. But ordinary Palestinians say that Israel is not serious about achieving peace.
The Israelis are not serious about peace talks, and Abbas should have understood that, and he should, like, go with his plans to go to the UN and ask for recognition of Palestine. I think it's a very good step, and he would get all the supports of Palestinians in this fact.
The plan backed by the Arab League. However, Palestinians want from other nations and freedom-loving people to stand by them.
If it does go through to the UN General Assembly, it's going to isolate the United States and Israel very quickly. They're the only two countries realistically that are probably going to oppose a Palestinian state at this point. I mean, there may be others, but it's going to be very few. And so they're going to be isolated in the international community very quickly. And that's their biggest concern.
Obtaining membership for the state of Palestine would require approval by the Security Council, where the United States holds veto power.
We are going to the UN, where Israel was named an independent state 64 years ago. We're going back there to demand the world recognizes our state. Israel is facing a crisis due to the growing support for Palestine.
Talks have not been successful in bringing an end to the prolonged conflict, which started in 1948, when Israel was created on Palestinian land. Since then, Palestinians have been struggling for self-determination and liberty.
We hope that the United Nations actually would recognize Palestinian state and endorse its step that started in 1974 when they recognized PLO to speak on behalf of the Palestinians.
Israel has defied numerous UN resolutions since its existence. In turn, the Palestinians under Israeli occupation have exhausted all options, including diplomatic ones, saying that independence is not a matter for negotiation. As the Palestinian leadership is determined to go to the UN's General Assembly in September, it remains to be seen if an independent Palestinian state would be declared and become the UN's 194th member. Yusuf Al-Hilo for Remember Palestine, Gaza.
My first studio guest hails from Jerusalem and is in London completing his PhD in international law, as well as being an advocate of Palestinian rights through his work with lawyers here and in his homeland. He's also chair of the Camden Abu Dis Friendship Association. It's good to see you again, Munir.
Thank you.
This is a very heated, complex issue of the PA's push for statehood status for Palestine. Legally, what does this mean?
In fact, in 1988, the PLO already announced and declared Palestine as a state. This was a declaration made from Algeria when the PLO was in exile. So this was the first declaration, main declaration of state from the PLO. And so this is not a new declaration of statehood. This is more this state, which is occupied, is seeking membership in the United Nations. This is the main legal change that the PLO is seeking to do. It's seeking to be recognized as a state member to the United Nations, which will probably open certain gates for this Palestinian state to for example, become a member at the International Criminal Court, which will give certain benefits, probably. To be a member in the General Assembly, to be able to vote in any General Assembly resolutions. So it's mainly to use certain instruments that exist in the world, to be also a member, for example, as a state of international human rights conventions and international humanitarian law conventions, which means that in such a case, if it was a member, then probably it will be able more to get Israel accountable.
But here's the rub. Isn't the onus on Israel, who are already a state, who already get to vote, to live up to its international regulations, to live up to its responsibilities?
Exactly. And this was going to, you know, this is the thing. It's not going to make really a big difference. At the end of the day, the occupied Palestinian territory, before the declaration of the state, will continue to be the occupied Palestinian territory after the declaration of the state. So unless you can actually end the occupation itself, then the difference is not going to be really enormous. It's going to be more of a diplomatic change. It's going to be more of a political new definition, if it was successful, of course. It's going to maybe single out the countries that will not accept the state. But in effect, already the declaration has happened. There are more than 100, since 1988, more than 100 recognitions of the state. So it's not really a big difference. And there is a lot of question about whether this is actually helpful or not. There are also...
That's a big whether this is helpful or not. Now, we understand that it might not change much diplomatically, but whether it's helpful, that's a different thing. What do you mean by that?
The question is, how are we really going to benefit? The main problem is the occupation. We have an army. It controls your export, your import, your life, your ID card, your passport. It builds illegal settlements in the occupied territory. It has a blockade on your sea. So basically, it's an occupation. The big question in the Palestinian mind, and from a humanitarian point of view as well, is what is going to drive the occupation out? So maybe in a big diplomatic effort, we might be able to get Palestine to be recognized as a state in the UN. But what does it take to make Palestine a state in Palestine is the actual real question that we have to continue to pose. And it seems that the PLO is trying in a way to redefine the conflict as a state versus a state, which also can be also a bit dangerous. I'm afraid that one day there will be, of course, an argument will be advanced that, well, there is now a Palestinian state, even though it's still occupied. It will be argued the Palestinians have determined their destiny, they exercise their right to self-determination. And then this redefinition can be also dangerous. So it is a really confusing step that
it's going to be very interesting times come September. I'm going to bring somebody else into this discussion because we're going to go down the line to Ramallah to speak with Dr. Hussam Zomnot, who's worked as the Deputy Commissioner of the Fatah International Affairs Commission and previously served as a PLO representative to the UK. Doctor, are you there, sir?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Thank you for speaking with us, Dr. Zomnot. We've just been hearing from my studio guests that this is a very, very complicated, difficult issue. What can you tell me from Ramallah that's going on at the moment?
What's going on is very simple. There is a decision, a collective decision by the Palestinians, by their leadership, to bring back the Palestinian cause where it is ought to be. That is the international legality, the international legitimacy as represented by the United Nations. It's as simple as that. So Palestine has been subjected to bilateral negotiations for 20 years. We have reaped nothing but more settlements, and Israel has been engaged in a game of deceit rather than a genuine serious negotiations to end occupation and dismantle all the settlements and to resolve four core issues, primarily and chiefly among them the issue of refugees and the return and the right of return. And therefore, we are going back to the international system, and we are seeking a very clear-cut definition of what is ours and what is theirs.
America has come out very vocally against this initiative. How's the pressure bearing up there?
America is a very important player in the international system and international relations. We acknowledge that, but America is not the only player. There is international consensus, international agreements. We have been engaged in international partnership between us and the international community for the last 20 years. We have done every single commitment that we have committed ourselves to, including building institutions and laying the foundations for the state to come. We have done it by the dot. And now it's the time that the international community will deliver back their commitments. And the best we can do is to gain this very clear-cut recognition of our state, albeit and despite that it is under occupation, and a very clear-cut provision of terms of reference, what the international community means by the two-state solution and by the resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. So, America might not be very pleased with that, but we are proceeding nonetheless.
Thank you very much, sir. Dr. Zamlet there, coming out of Ramallah, a seasoned Palestinian diplomat with a lot to say on the issue. We'll, of course, be following this one as it gets closer to that all-important vote in the UN in September. Now, when scores of activists flew into Tel Aviv on their humanitarian mission to highlight the plight of the Palestinians living under occupation, few thought for a minute that the authorities would give them a hug and wave them in on their way. But many were still surprised at the ferocity of the Israeli welcome and the silence that greeted their requests for assistance from British authorities where British citizens and their rights were concerned.
The right to travel is second nature to British citizens, who assume that wherever in the world they go, they will be protected by the British authorities. But a few weeks ago, when about 13 British citizens were arrested, detained, and then deported by the Israeli authorities for trying to visit the West Bank, the British authorities have yet to say anything about the incident.
Hi, Les.
One of the activists, Les Lebedow, said far from the authorities showing concern for their welfare, on the way to Israel, they were stopped by what appeared to be MI5 and questioned about their intentions.
One person checking our boarding card was obviously not an airport official. Always seemed to be someone different, perhaps from MI5, and he asked us questions of a sort that I'd never been asked before, such as, where do you plan to go in the country? Are you aware of a demonstration? I said, no, can you tell me about it? Didn't. And just advised me to watch out.
Press TV contacted the Foreign Office to ask why they have not yet taken up the ill treatment of its citizens with the Israelis. But the Foreign Office failed to respond. Longtime supporter of Justice for Palestine, Lord Nazir Ahmed, said Britain's close relationship with Israel compromised its ability to be vocally critical of that country's treatment of the Palestinians and British citizens who support them.
The Foreign and Commonwealth Office, I think sometimes, is seen to be too close to the Israeli government, and that's why, because they don't want to upset Israel, because if they upset Israel, the strong lobbies in New York would then have influence on the American government, who would then have consequences on our government as well.
For the activists, the authorities' failure to speak out in this instance is just the tip of the iceberg in what they see as Britain's complicity in Israel's endless violation of the rights of Palestinian citizens.
The main targets and victims of this whole operation are the Palestinians, who had invited us and who are systematically denied the right to have visitors, unlike even people in prisons.
Last year, David Cameron condemned the attack on the Freedom Flotilla as unacceptable. This year, none of the activists at Ben Gurion Airport were killed, but many of them say that they were attacked while they were detained by the Israeli authorities for up to 4 days. Palestinian advocates have been left wondering what it will take for their own British government to come out in support of them against the Israeli authorities.
Now my guest, James Haywood, he led members of a university group on a trip to Gaza to meet some of their peers and see with their own eyes conditions on the ground there. Why Gaza, James, and why now?
At Golsis, we've been doing trips to the West Bank in Palestine for a long time now, it must be 3 years now. Gaza, we've never been able to get into before. After the Egyptian revolution, we naively thought that it'd be an opportunity for us to get through the Rafah crossing with Egypt. And, after a lot of difficulty, we did eventually get in. So it was important for us. This seemed like the perfect opportunity to finally get to Gaza.
What were you hoping to see, and what did you see?
Our main goal was to just be an eyewitness to the siege, to the conditions in Gaza, and we got more than our fair share of that. I mean, you can't go anywhere in Gaza without seeing the devastation. There were so many things you don't see in the press, which we were able to experience, like electricity, because Israel destroyed the only power plant in Gaza. So electricity is a huge problem, and because we were staying with families, we were with students the entire time, we really were able to get a feeling of just how much things like, the smallest thing like electricity can affect so much the daily life of people.
What were they telling you, Gazans, with whom, you know, you were sleeping, eating, talking?
I mean, it's funny because you begin to realise that what Palestinians suffer more than anything else is racism. And so there's just little things, just being with students, being with fishermen, with, you know, family members. You just realise these are just normal people. They're just like me and you. They've just got the same aspirations as us. They've got the same, they want to lead normal lives, but are being fundamentally denied this by the occupation, by the racism they suffer from Israel, from the international community. And that was one of the most incredible things we were able to grasp, really, was just, you know, the image is so, even for activists like myself, you still have this image of it being, you know, extremist or terrorism, all that kind of nonsense you hear in the media. But just being able to meet people who were just normal people, it was, you know, it was an important experience to have.
What did they say they wanted?
Freedom, simple as that. The freedom to live normal lives, the freedom to, simple thing, just to go and visit Egypt, simplest thing like that, is incredibly difficult for them. The freedom to be able to visit where their grandparents grew up, you know, in what's now Israel. The fact that we could go and visit where their grandparents lived, where they were expelled from in 1948. We as Europeans could visit those areas, those towns, those villages, but they couldn't, as Palestinians who had family there. I mean, that just sums it up, really, how much racism they actually suffer. So it's that basic freedom that they're after more than anything else.
Well, we've got a brief snapshot of some of the thoughts of the counterparts that James had on that trip to Gaza. Here's a little bit of what they had to say.
A delegation of students travelled from the UK and crossed the Rafah border to enter Gaza. This year, their annual one-week journey included meetings with the community of the Islamic University of Gaza, where they also signed a statement of friendship. The group toured other areas of the region, such as the largest medical complex in Gaza, the Al-Shifa Hospital, to experience the occupation firsthand. Here are some of their reactions during their tour.
The purpose of the visit of the student delegation from London to Gaza is to, first of all, bring our solidarity to the Palestinian people from Gaza and to the Palestinian people in general.
Clearly this hospital isn't even big enough for this section of town, this neighbourhood, you know, never mind the whole of Gaza. And if you think as well that with everything that's been destroyed and the fact there are a shortage of medicines, you know, and a shortage of staff.
The way that people have been dealing with their, you know, stripping of human rights, which they received so far in this country, it was absolutely disgraceful, and how they're managing is just incredible.
James Haywood is still here with me. Brought back some memories, that did.
Definitely, yeah.
What do you want people who are witnessing this interview between us to take from your visit there? Because actually, we can't talk to the people who you spoke to. What message are you trying to bring to us?
Definitely. Well, I think the main message, and this is coming straight from the Palestinians, is to hold Israel and the international community to account on these things. We met the Al-Samouni family, who I'm sure many of your viewers may have known were a family completely massacred during Operation Cast Lead. 29 members of the same family killed, all their farmland destroyed. We met them. They said that Judge Goldstone from the United Nations had come to visit them. He'd cried when he'd heard their story. He was hugging them. He went back, obviously made the UN report, the Goldstone report, which said that Israel committed war crimes. Well, 2 months before we'd arrived in Gaza, he'd then retracted that statement, saying, no, I was wrong. They said, we don't blame Israel for this. We blame the international community because Israel is being allowed to get away with a massacre daily in Gaza. And actually, that's the crucial thing we got out of there. We met groups, for example, from the boycott campaign launched from Gaza, who were saying, you go home, you hold yourself to account by boycotting goods, by boycotting the, by supporting the academic boycott, by the cultural boycott. All these things are crucial ways which helped in South Africa holding the apartheid regime to account, and can definitely help now in holding Israel to account.
Thank you, James. Well, all across the globe, activists and civil society, they want to remind the Palestinian people that, although it might feel like it sometimes, the world's not forgotten her, and Palestine's trouble. Here's a roundup of recent events.
Palestinians and Israelis demonstrated alongside each other in eastern Jerusalem, Al-Quds, demanding the recognition of independence for Palestine. During the Jewish-Arab event, the first of its kind in 20 years, campaigners marched along the Green Line used to separate East and West Jerusalem in 1967. The action was a collaboration between the Left Movement of Solidarity, Sheikh Jarrah, and the International Committee of East Jerusalem.
This demonstration means for me that Arab and the Israeli left wing together against the occupation of Jerusalem and the West Bank.
People of all ages and walks of life came together in France to condemn the interception of the Freedom Flotilla 2 by the Greek government. They spelled out their message by making the words Free Gaza with a human chain next to the Eiffel Tower in Paris.
We want freedom for Palestine. We want the end of the criminal blockade, which is difficult and inhumane for the people of Gaza.
Volunteers from across the world will travel to Palestine to help farmers pick olives in an effort to boost the economy. They will offer their support in particular in areas where the work of Palestinian farmers is deterred by the apartheid wall, confiscation of agricultural land and attacks. The annual olive picking campaign, which will take place in October, will also include events to explain how Israeli repression prevents families from benefiting from this traditional industry.
And that's a little bit of what you do, isn't it, James? The idea of maintaining solidarity, keeping the pressure up.
Definitely. It's a crucial thing that the Palestinians are asking us to do, is continue this international solidarity. And it does make a huge impact. And again, you know, being in Gaza, we saw the effect of this international solidarity, how people who've never left a strip 15 miles long in all their life, but, you know, can feel all this solidarity coming with. And actually, the crucial thing is, like what you've got here, is that it should go on YouTube, it should go on Facebook and Twitter, because so many Palestinians are blogging, so many are on Twitter and Facebook, and it's so important to break the siege through things like social media. With anything we do, needs to go on there so that it can empower Palestinians to know that they're not alone, despite what our governments are doing.
Well, and so we can get it on there as well. And that's all the time we have on today's programme. A very warm thank you for all my guests, and a very special salute to each and every one of you who've watched and continue to send in your comments and contribution. It's rp@presstv.co.uk, and we appreciate all of those messages. We leave you with these images of Gaza's youth, shot on cameras that our team left on a recent visit. This week's theme is family. As usual, a special thanks to Nada Issa for her help on this project. Until next time, from me and the team, I've been Amina Taylor. See ya.